So welcome to another episode of Spaghetti Code, and today we have the pleasure to have with us Luca Corti, which is the current CTO of Sibyl and former CTO of Dottori.it. Welcome, Luca, to Spaghetti Code.
Hi, thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here with you.
Luca, you have an interesting experience. In the last two jobs, at least, you have been CTO, and you started as a software engineer, as most of us. I would like to know a bit more about your experience and how the path from a software engineer brought you where you are today.
Started as an infrastructure engineer, as a system engineer. So I was working, my first job actually, it was in a data center. I was working for a small ISP.
So you were still working with cables?
Actually, I had a colleague who was colorblind. And he was actually in charge of repairing the servers, so swapping the units on the servers when they broke. And they had a LED, which turned red when it was broke. And he couldn't distinguish green from red. And so he was sending me pictures of the AC units to ask me if he had to swap them or not.
So, you know, the famous thing, cut blue cable or the red cable, which one do I need to cut, you know, explosion.
It was great actually, because I really had to manage hardware and software and servers remotely. Big innovation at the time was the remote KYC over IP, so you didn't have to connect keyboard and mouse to the server. You could do it from the office, because otherwise I had to get the scooter and go to the data center to fix it, right? Which a couple of times I had to do.
It was a good experience. It was a really small company, so I really had to do everything from hardware to software, to setting up servers, to configuring mail servers, DNS servers, actually, and NTP servers. I don't know if anyone still uses news groups, but it was a thing at the time. We sold connectivity, so it was early 2000s, so we sold ADSL. It was like the broadband, the hot broadband thing at the time. It was an autonomous system, so we had BGP routers. So I learned a lot from that. And from there, I moved to network engineering. So I worked for a company and I was doing mostly networking. And then slowly I moved to development. At first, I got a job as a mobile developer on native iOS applications. And then I moved to front-end and then I moved to back-end. I think the gist of my experience is that I always wanted to build things end-to-end. I didn't want to become specialized in a little piece, and I really wanted to know everything that was involved from my computer to the server processing the request to everything that you need to actually build something that people can use. And so I did a lot of different things. I never specialized in anything in particular. But during the years, I've been working in a number of different companies. So from really small companies like the ISP I first worked at, and larger companies, maybe a few hundred people. And then at some point, I got to work for one of the main telco operators in Italy, mobile telco operators, which was at the time 10,000 people, I guess, working on interesting stuff. E-commerce, on the e-commerce platform for them. And at some point, I guess I was a little bit stuck in my learning path, because I always wanted to learn stuff and I always wanted to learn new things. But at some point I realized that the technical part of the work is not enough. Most of the time, the problem was not with implementation. Most of the time, the problems, especially in larger companies, was organization, and was that people was not really able to make choices that could lead to something that had an actual impact on what we were doing. And I realized that to be able to shape things, drive things towards some kind of useful outcome, I had to move up in the organization. I had to actually be in a role where I could make some changes and where I could take decisions that could impact stuff from from technical decision to, I think, most importantly, organizational decisions, because that's what I guess a lot of the time is the issue with organizing groups of people and achieving business results, because that's in the end what you're going to do, right?
You decided to start a company with somebody, or did you join an existing company as a CTO? What was your experience there?
So I was working for this really large telco operator, and I was not really happy with it.
Okay.
So I was looking for a new job. Basically, I, at the time, I was kind of a team lead, so I was working with a group of people, and we were mm-hmm. doing this e-commerce platform. And I was looking for a new job, and actually I wasn't hired to be the CTO of Dottori. So I moved to Dottori because it was interesting, because I found what they were working on was interesting, but they actually had the CTO. And the company was going through a really large reorganization where they were trying to turn the existing service, which was really simple and not really a digital product, into an actual digital product with a different model. So with a subscription model instead of selling advertising mostly, which was what we were doing at the time.
Okay.
And I joined there as an architect, as an engineer, a senior engineer, to help with this. After a few months, the former CTO left the company, and the CEO basically offered me to take his job. And it was so mostly out of luck. Yes. So it wasn't really my decision. It wasn't really something that happened because I did something specific. It happened because I was really lucky to meet this person. I had a great relationship with Angela, and we worked together to basically build what was the vision for the product and the company.
That's cool. Now at the current company you're working with, I think the team is a bit smaller. Right. And so what I was wondering is what is the difference between a company that is already established? So a lot of things, a lot of decisions have been already made, and maybe you have to revert them, or, you know, you need to adjust them and you need to evolve them anyway, with a company where things are a bit more greenfield and you need to build it from the scratch, the product, you need to build from the scratch the team. What do you see different in those two environments?
First thing that comes to mind is that greenfield projects don't really exist. When you join anything, even an early stage startup company like Sibyl, like the one I'm working at right now, you still have some kind of MVP. You have some kind of initial stuff that was done to attract investments, initial investments, to prove the idea, to do something. And so you will always start from something that already exists, and you have to deal with it in a way or another. I guess the difference is that it's not as bad as in a company like Dottori, where when I joined, they were in their seventh year, I guess. They really had a lot of legacy stuff, and by a lot, I mean really a lot, and it was bad. It was really in a really bad shape, and it was really hard to steer the boat. There was a lot of inertia due to technical debt.
Mm.
And that's not happening right now, because in a small companies and small startup, like in the last year, we mostly erased everything that was problematic that was left from someone who did the early development. And we are moving really fast. So that's the main thing. That when I worked at Dottori, I worked there for around 3 years. We didn't get rid of all the technical debt with a much larger team.
I think one of the main sort of points of friction when, you know, trying to handle tech debt is the, you know, balancing tech debt with, you know, business sort of objectives, speed. So I guess you're taking a lot from what you have learned, you know, in Dottori. In this new company, but still, I suppose you're still facing this type of challenges where, you know, you need to decide whether it's the right time to tackle technical debt versus, you know, doing it later because there are more pressing sort of business requirements. Are you still, I don't know, do you have any specific advice? Is there anything that you have learned that kind of helps you make this type of decision now?
Easy question. Yes and no. I guess that this is one of the biggest things that you have to learn to manage, to steer when you are in any kind of leadership role in a company. And it's always hard, I guess, in a way. What I know for sure is that you cannot embark in something that is a full rewrite and say, okay, let's just make a full rewrite of this because it doesn't work and let's not do anything else for the next 6 months. That's something that will never work. Even if by chance or luck you get to do it, it's not going to end well. And I don't think you should anyway. So the real problem is to balance things. You need to juggle the requirements you have, the business requirements you have, the desires of a lot of people and stakeholders, obviously.
Yeah.
And you have to balance that with something that won't end up in not being able to work anymore because you have too much stuff that is not working well enough. So it's really hard. The main thing is to be able to look at what you are doing with in an as much objective way as possible. A lot of times I hear a lot of theories around how you should build your system. You should do in the last few years it's microservices. Let's do microservices. Okay, so if I chose to use microservices, for example, and I have a team of 4 developers, how are we going to build all the stuff that is needed to support that kind of architecture and operate it without anyone doing, with me doing operations? It's a lot of complexity.
Yeah.
So that will be, I guess, really a poor choice. And I think my point is that you can't take any tool and decide that that's the right tool for the job in any situation. It's not realistic. I mean, if you're going to build something, the first thing you have to take into consideration is what you need to build and the resources that you have to build.
Exactly.
It.
Yeah.
And the kind of decisions that you make today will be probably different from the kind of decisions you will be making in a couple of years, in 3 years, when you will have maybe more funding and more resources to do your job. But you're not there. You're not there yet. And you can make those decisions based on something that you don't have today. I think that what really helps in this kind of situation is having done the mistake before. And I did. For example, in Dottori, I did it. They had this really bad monolith. And I said, okay, let's try and do microservices. And it didn't work out. It was too much work, too complicated. The domain was really big. We had a lot of stuff. People was not really experienced with that kind of architecture, and it was a mistake. And I think the best thing I did there was to acknowledge that I was wrong and revert that decision and go back to building something simpler, more monolithic architecture, because we weren't really getting anywhere with that. So making mistakes is the best way to gain experience, and then you can leverage that experience in the context you're working in. Yeah,
absolutely. There's one thing you said earlier that's interesting to me, which is even though you got your first CTO role by luck to an extent, I think you already felt ready for that type of role. To an extent. So is there anything that you want to recommend to people that are aspiring to become a CTO, any specific muscles they need to flex and practice on before trying that type of role in your experience?
I think the classic problem with engineers trying to do something different from engineering, so you spend a lot of time, like I did, working on technical stuff, and because you are really passionate about it, so you love building stuff, and I always love building stuff, and I still love building stuff, and you develop a perspective on things, And the perspective is what I need to build this stuff, and will it work? Won't it work? What problems will I have? What problems I want to have, and what problems I don't want to have with this? And that's not really the job when you are trying to look at the problem from a different perspective, because you are going to look at the problem and you will be asked to provide results, which is a completely different thing. And it's not the way you are used to think about stuff. And so I guess you should try and role play a little bit and imagine that you are talking to an engineer, but you are not the engineer. And you don't know anything about building a system or building what you want to be done. And that's the perspective, I guess. And it's really hard if you haven't really done it before. You need to try, and I guess you need to be wrong. Is a lot by experience also, and making mistakes. And that's what I meant when I said that I didn't really prepare for it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do it. I don't think I was ready to do it.
Okay.
I think I was ready to be wrong at it. And I really wanted to try it. So this was my motivation. So there was the luck part, was finding someone that was willing to bet on me, because it was a bet, obviously. I didn't have any experience at any kind of top management role in a company. I was lucky to find someone who was willing to bet on myself, but I don't think that's enough. I mean, I think if you're an engineer, you really want to ask yourself, what do you enjoy working on? Because it's not going to be engineering.
Exactly.
A lot of the time. You will have to work on something that is more, like, you have to sell stuff to people. You have to hire members of the team. And oftentimes, if you are purely on technical merit, you probably won't end up with a great team. So you have to learn to talk to people, understand what they want, and try to build a team where you can really mix people that can work together and want to work together and are compatible, which is totally different from being a great developer in any language or being a great engineer. So it's going to be really different.
I mean, how did you learn which type of people? Because you said you never had a management role in another company before, right? I mean, you were a tech lead in the previous company. I don't know if you had already line management experience or responsibilities. And how did you learn this type of things you are talking about, that you have to hire certain type of people with certain personality so that you can mix them up and they can work well together?
I did mistakes. I just faced one problem at a time. I also was confident on my engineering skills, and that's, I guess, important. It really depends, obviously. If you're the CTO of a big company, of Amazon, of Facebook, Google, it's a political job. So you won't be doing any coding. You will have a lot of people that can take care of engineering. It's a people job. Of course, that's not my job. I still write a lot of code. I do a lot of engineering, but I guess in this kind of setting, having technical skills and a strong technical foundation will help you. And that's the requirement for the job. So you have to know your stuff really well, but that's only the requirement. So the management part, you build it on top. And I didn't have much management experience when I started as a CTO of Dottori. I had theories. I had theories on how I would do the job, on how I would hire people, on how I would organize work, on what was an efficient way of managing a technical team and what wasn't. Some of that worked out, some of that didn't work out. And so the other thing is that you need to be willing to learn from what you do and accept that you will be doing a lot of mistakes, just like as it happens when you are doing engineering.
You know, given your experience and your path, how did you convince the people that you were leading, that you were the right person? Because, you know, you said it was the first time for me to take over this team, so I wasn't ready. And I think when you jump into this role, even if you move from engineering management, you're never ready to take on the full organization, because there are things that you don't know that you need to face, right? And you just know them when you see them and when you are on the spot directly.
So I think it really depends on the kind of organization and how you end up there. Because as we were saying earlier, there's a big difference between big companies, between a startup and maybe a more greenfield project, or a small company like Dottori was, with a small development team. So when I joined, there were a few developers, but not many. It was probably 5-6 people in the tech team. When I took on the role of CTO, I made it, I think, really clear what was the expectation. I don't think I had to justify, or I felt the need to gain their trust. Somehow you get the job, you get the role, you get the responsibility. And that's it. So I think initially with the people who were already there, I made it really clear how I wanted stuff to be done, how I expected from people, what I expected from them. Someone was on board and they stayed, and they stayed actually until we were acquired. Some other people wasn't on board and they left. And that's totally fine with me. You really need to define what's acceptable and what's not acceptable if you want to build something new. And I think this is probably true in all situations when there is a change of some kind. If you want to enforce change in an existing organization, there will be people that are happy about it, people that won't be happy about it. And if you give them the impression that there is the chance that things will not change, that's worse. That's really bad. Because you are basically saying that they are in charge of, and that they have the power to stop any change in the company. And that's not what you want.
This leads me to the next question. You know, you mentioned that during your tenure as a CTO of Dottori, the company has been acquired. So you kind of found yourself on the other side, right? So you have been acquired and you become, you know, one of the many, let's say, and you have a new boss, because I guess you got a new boss at that point, right? And how was this experience as a CTO? You know, you are a CTO, you can take decision on, as you said, on technical decision, on people decision. And now suddenly you get acquired by a big company, a big corporation.
So it felt like being on holiday at first. So the company, like Dottori, grew from 30 to 120 people in 2 years and a half, also during COVID. And the tech team grew from 5 to 25 people. And the growth was, like, the company was growing 40% year over year, every year.
You mean the headcount? Or the headcount in terms of revenue?
No, also revenue.
Also revenue.
So it was growing, like, really fast during the, the time I was there. That was the feeling. I mean, we built a lot of stuff. We built an invoicing system, we built payment system, we built a lot of stuff that we were selling, actually. And so every 2-3 months we were launching new features for the doctors, for our customers and for patients. It was really fast. It was really, if you like building things like I did, it was really fun. That's fun. That you have the, like, you are shipping, continuously shipping new stuff and to users. And the company is growing and everything is going fine. And that's a lot of fun. Then we got acquired and I was out of a job. Basically, that was it. No one expected me to do any of the stuff that I was doing before. And so I didn't really know what to do. I was doing meetings, obviously. During the day, Also meetings that I didn't really enjoy sometimes, like compliance, legal stuff. There was, of course, the due diligence for the acquisition. Not as fun as building things, for reasons you might understand. So I wasn't really enjoying it. Of course, like you cannot expect like a 3,000 people company to be the same as a 100 people company, and I didn't. But also I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. So at some point I was bored. I felt like I had to have a lot of discussions to change nothing or really small stuff. And that I had no impact at all in the decisions that were made. And so I guess I realized that it wasn't for me. Like I didn't really enjoy the kind of company the processes that were involved in building stuff. It was really different from what I had been experiencing in the previous 2 years and a half.
You know, in that kind of situation, kind of setting, how do you keep the team unite? Because at the end of the day, you know, if as a leader, the leader of the team, you're not buying in this new situation, you know, you're still working for the company, right? So you need to make sure that you keep the team unite.
I don't know, I guess that was the most difficult thing for me, because I hired most of them directly. We worked together every day. Again, we are talking about 25 people, so I knew every one of them. I worked with them every day. We talked when they needed technical advice. I was there. When they needed anything, I was there. I didn't really feel I could provide that anymore, because I wasn't like mostly making any of the decisions about their future. I wasn't in control anymore. And so I think that's one of the big reasons also why I felt like I couldn't do what I was doing before, that was trying to help them with anything they needed. Because that's maybe some advice for people wanting to take on a management role. The title might sound fancy, but you actually are in charge of all the problems of everyone, and everything is going to come to you, and you will have to manage it some way. And this is also not something that everyone wants to do, or that anyone enjoys. I did actually enjoy building a team, and also to be held accountable for the choices I made and for how the choices I made impacted them. And that's the point. I wasn't really accountable anymore, because I guess to be accountable for something, you need to be able to make some decisions, because otherwise you are just like being blamed for the outcome of something that you didn't choose. And I didn't feel that I had that power anymore to influence the way they worked and the way they felt.
This is very interesting. We were talking about the toll that the management takes on people. You know, it's as you said, at the end of the day, all the problem of people come to you. And, you know, even if we always say we should have a clear split between private life and working life, it's not. I mean, we can't really make a straight division between the two. You know, they influence each other, obviously. And I think it's normal as well. We're not machine, you know, we're not there on a supply chain that we do our little work and then we move on. No, we are complex human beings. So it's always all connected.
Since we're talking about, you know, people and, you know, and managing people and you know, making sure that the team is happy, what recommendations do you have for hiring people? As you said, you know, you don't look only for the technical skills, so you need to make sure that, you know, that the person you're hiring is fitting well with the rest of the team. But do you have any specific sort of advice or even any sort of interview process aspect that you think works particularly well for the companies you've been at?
Easy question again. So in I guess Dottori is the like the place where I really started to do hiring.
Okay.
I think I did probably in the hundreds of interviews for engineers, okay, mostly. Across the couple of years I was there and I was hiring the team actively. So by trial and error, mostly. You won't be right all the time. There is no magic recipe. I think you start to develop some kind of intuition when you start to do a lot of interviews, because at some point you are an engineer and you are going to start to see patterns in people too. So you will start to see that you will start to recognize the behavior of people during interviews. Also, I think I developed a bit of my own style of doing that, which was mostly talking with people about their experience. I don't really believe in whiteboard interviews or this kind of stuff. I guess that's some kind of thing that maybe is necessary when you need to screen a lot of people, especially in really large companies, because there's a lot of competition for getting into large companies where you have, of course, life-changing salaries and that kind of stuff. And there are dynamics around that. Mostly when I'm doing interviews, I'm focusing on two things, relevant experience and technical stuff. I think around that you can develop a pretty good intuition, even if you are not doing whiteboard interviews, because if you have been an engineer for 10, 15, 20 years, you talk to someone and you start from like really generic stuff. Maybe you start from their experience. Maybe you then try to get them to describe what they were working on in some kind of context that you think what is interesting or interests you. And then you start to dig deeper. You basically want to see how deep you can go. And that's one side of the interview process. The other side of the interview process is trying to understand the person you have in front of you, trying to understand what they are looking for, what motivates them, what they want to achieve with their next job, because that's also something that is going to affect how they will be, their performance, if you end up hiring them. Yeah, this was the process in the most of it. I think I did this like around 100 times, and sometimes it went great, sometimes it went less great. Sometimes I even knew I was doing a mistake hiring someone, but I did it anyway, maybe for some other reason. Because at some point I started delegating, for example, the technical part of the interviews when the team grew. And I wanted other people to make mistakes. There was one case where there was one of the tech leads at the Tori, and we interviewed someone and he told me, yeah, candidate is great. And then I had to do a follow-up, and I still did follow-ups to make sure that like there was a fit and I was on board with the decision. I talked to this person and I went back to my tech lead and I said to him, I don't think we should hire him. Not on a technical basis, but I think this will be a problem. I didn't see a fit with the team and I saw issues. It was probably brilliant, but it was not going to fit well in the team. But if you want to hire him, we'll hire him. So the final decision is yours. For the same reason that, like, I said it a few times already, but you really learn by being wrong. And if you think you are right, you need to be wrong. You need to make a mistake.
Absolutely. And
in that case, I was willing to do this mistake. I think it was a great opportunity to learn from experience and not from an appeal to authority where I could have just said, no, I won't hire him because I don't like him or I think there will be a problem.
And were you right in the end?
Yes, I was. Unfortunately, yes, I was. You also need to, at some point, when a team grows and you go from 5 to 25 people, at some point you also need to grow people in the team.
Absolutely.
To do things that you are not going to be able to do anymore. And that was part of it. That's part of it, I guess. At some point, you need to move some responsibility to other people. And as I had the opportunity to be wrong and to make mistakes and to learn from them, You also need to create that space for other people on your team. If you don't, you will end up being the one making all the decisions, and as the team grows, it won't scale, and you will be really unhappy, and you will be really tired, and you will be working a lot. And I don't think that's like that's also a big part of making the transition from engineer to manager. You have to realize at some point that you have to accept that some things, a lot of things, won't be under your control directly. You will have to trust people with some decisions, and you want that.
Absolutely.
Even if you don't know it, you want that. You want people to grow, and you want other people to make decisions instead of you. If you don't do it, it's not going to work out for you, and it's not going to work out for the company you work for.
I think we're ending the episode now, coming to an end. We usually ask this to all the people on the show, if you have any specific resource that you want to recommend, you know, the people on our audience, related to what we have discussed, or anything else that you're kind of passionate about, books, mailing lists, blog posts, anything really.
Okay, so I mostly follow a few podcasts lately. I find it easier because I have a, even though I read a lot in the past, I'm finding it harder and harder to spend a lot of time reading outside work, because I also read a lot of stuff during work. Podcasts are a great way. So I mostly follow stuff around Elixir, which is my main interest right now, which may not be interesting to everyone. More closely on the CTO topic, there's a great resource I ran into some time ago, which is the Startup CTO Handbook by Zach Goldberg. It's freely available on GitHub, and I think it's a bit of a collection of a lot of stuff that practical stuff maybe. It's full of practical advice on a lot of stuff that you will have to do when you take on a leadership role, and I guess it really gives you a lot of the ideas and a great starting point to manage a lot of stuff. The other great resource, and something that we didn't touch on today, but this is, I think, one of the most important things. I've been working with ShapeUp a lot in the last few years. It's also freely available. It's a methodology from Basecamp to mostly manage product development and then the delivery cycle of something. And I think it touches on a lot of things that are most problematic when you want to build something which is not the programming language or the technical stuff, but oftentimes trying to understand what you want to build and how you can start from an idea and get to a result which in the end will be close to what you were looking for, and navigate the complexities around working with a team of people. And I think it captures a lot of this stuff pretty well, and it's a great, I think, resource if you find yourself also in a CTO role, and also to having to talk to business stakeholders, and maybe you have a product partner, you have to somehow build a process. And I think ShapeUp is a great starting point for building a product development process, and something that is related also to software development in many ways.
Okay, cool. I couldn't help to notice that you didn't mention Spaghetti Code among the podcasts you are following, which means we will probably not publish this episode. We're going to cancel it. But, you know, we thank you anyway for the time.
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I listened to, I think, most of the episodes of Spaghetti Code when you invited me on the podcast, because I didn't before.
You're digging, but, you're digging the hole, eh?
So it's one of the podcasts I actually really closely. I think I'm up to the latest episode right now. So I have notifications turned on, I guess. For Spaghetti Code. Yeah, I do.
It's fine. It's okay. Don't worry. Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, joke aside, thank you very much for the time, and it's been a pleasure to have you here.
Really nice to meet you, Luca.
Thanks, it was great too. And also thanks for having me.